Hello everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show on Myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Panel, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. This is Cure Panel's 68th episode. As Cure Panel completes 2 years this August, I take this opportunity to thank everyone who has been a part of our show and hope that Cure Panel has touched lives in a positive manner. We need your love and support to continue to bring you the latest. Thank you very much. On our myeloma broadcast today, we are discussing high-risk multiple myeloma. My co-host for the show is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. On the panel are Cure panelists Pat Killingsworth and Jack Aiello. Nick Van Dyke, who was supposed to join us today, is unable to do so and apologizes on his behalf. We have with us a very eminent expert, Dr. Sagar Lonial. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lonial. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We have received an overwhelming response to the show, and before I hand over to Gary to begin with the discussion, I would like to tell all listeners that we will be addressing questions towards the end of the show, and if you want to ask a question to our panel, you can press 1 on your keypad, and we will bring you on air to ask your question. Alternatively, if you prefer that I ask your question, you can email your question to me. Mailing ID is priya@trialx.com. With that, it's over to Gary. Gary, you're on air.
Well, thank you, Priya, and thank you for bringing this forum for all of us, and thank everybody, all the people on the panel, as well as all the callers, and of course you, Dr. Lonial, for your contribution to all you do for the treatment of the patients and the patient community. Before we get going, I'd like to introduce the doctor. Dr. Sagar Lonial, is an internationally recognized as a leading authority in multiple myeloma treatment and research. He's a professor and vice chair of clinical affairs, Department of Hematology and Medical Oncology at Emory University School of Medicine. He's the vice chair of the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, Myeloma Committee, as well as the chair of the steering committee for the Multiple Myeloma Research Consortium. As a medical oncologist at Winship Cancer Institute, Dr. Lonial treats patients with multiple myeloma as a lead member of the bone marrow transplantation team and clinical trials team. He is involved in numerous professional organizations, including the American Society of Clinical Oncology, American Society of Hematology, and American Society of Blood and Marrow Transplantation. Additionally, Dr. Lonial is on the board of directors for the International Myeloma Society and on the scientific advisory board for the International Myeloma Foundation. He also has an excellent background with a degree in medicine from the University of Louisville, with residency at Baylor College, and a fellowship in hematology oncology at Emory University. And so I don't believe that leaves you a whole heck of a lot of spare time, does it, Doctor?
No, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the group here and talk a little bit about some of the really exciting data that we've had from our group published in the last year. So I think it's important as we begin the discussion on prognosis and treatment options for patients with high-risk myeloma that we step back just a little bit and talk about some of the features that put patients into the category of high risk as compared to standard risk. And if you go back over time, there have been a number of prognostic features that have developed in the laboratory assessment of patients with myeloma. Simple things like creatinine or kidney function, albumin, beta 2 microglobulin, C-reactive protein, some other things that we've known that can help distinguish patients who have myeloma that seems to be proliferating or growing at a much higher rate compared to myeloma that does not appear to be proliferating or growing. And one of the important distinctions, I think, that patients and physicians need to keep in mind is that in general, myeloma is a slow-growing disease. What identifies subsets of patients that have high-risk disease are a couple of things, but one of the most important is probably the ability of those cells to divide and turn over more rapidly. And so when we talk about things like the International Staging System or ISS staging criteria, what differentiates functionally stage 1 from stage 3 is how fast those cells divide, because that drives up the beta 2 microglobulin, a common test that's used for screening and staging patients with myeloma. Now, as we've learned more about myeloma over the last decade or so, we started to identify that there are different genetic subsets of patients with myeloma. And so that while growth and proliferation, how fast those cells are dividing, may be one common readout that separates standard from high-risk myeloma, what contributes to those cells dividing more rapidly has to do with lots of genetic abnormalities. And those can include abnormalities that are picked up on what we call routine cytogenetics, which is a different test from what's called FISH analysis, or fluorescence in situ hybridization, known as FISH testing by most of us. And the difference is, and I'm going to give you a little bit of basic biology here, when we look at regular chromosomes in tumor cells, the only way we can really tell them apart from normal cells is that tumor cells tend to divide a little bit faster. And in 85% of patients with myeloma, the myeloma cells are not dividing fast enough for us to be able to identify there are chromosomal abnormalities. And so 85% of patients with myeloma have normal cytogenetics. What that means is that doing regular chromosome analysis, you're going to not see abnormalities in almost 90% of patients. But we know that every patient, almost every patient with myeloma, has something that's abnormal in their tumor cells. And that's where FISH testing comes in, where you don't require the cell to be dividing, and you can identify known abnormalities. And so there are some common high-risk abnormalities that we look for. Translocation 414 is one. Translocation 1416 is another. Translocation 1420 is another. Deletion 17P. These are all abnormalities that we pick up using FISH testing to look for specific common genetic abnormalities that identify patients with having high-risk myeloma. So that's one way that these groups can be identified. And we tend to lump these groups together. If you have 414 or 17P or 1416, many of us, and in fact in the clinical trial from our group, we lumped all those patients together and said, these are all high-risk patients. There are also clinical features that can be associated with high-risk myeloma. And those include things like an elevated LDH. LDH is a blood test. It's done on routine chemistries. That tends to be associated with high-risk myeloma. Patients that present with kidney failure, those patients are at a higher risk of having high-risk myeloma because those diseases tend to be a little bit more faster-growing, more proliferative than patients who don't present with kidney failure. So there are some clinical features, there are some laboratory features, and then, of course, there's some investigational tools like sequencing, gene expression profiling that can also add in to the mix and help to identify some patients with high-risk myeloma. One of the questions that was asked of me is, could I describe some of the work that we published in our paper in Leukemia last year? And what we did in that analysis was look at a large cohort of patients who came to our center over about a 3 or 4 year period of time. And when I say large with high risk at a single institution, I think it was somewhere between 50 and 60 patients. And what we did for all of those patients was give them the same 3-drug induction. They got a regimen called RVD, which is Velcade, Revlimid, and Dex, or for those of you in CME land, bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. All patients got a single cycle of high-dose therapy and transplant, and then they all were put on RVD maintenance, those same three drugs we used in the beginning, but we put it on the back end. And they got RVD maintenance for 3 years. And so that maintenance schedule is what we think is really important to the long-term survival of those patients with multiple myeloma. And if you look at how long the average remission duration lasted, it was somewhere around 30 months, just a little bit shy of 3 years. But the overall survival for that group was well over 80% at 3 to 3.5 years. And just to put this number in perspective of 80% survival, 80-plus percent survival at 3 years, if you look at patients with high-risk disease as we defined it in that study looked at survival from many other large randomized trials, the average survival for those patients is less than 3 years. So 50% survived just about 3 years, whereas at ours it was well over 80% or well beyond that. So a significant improvement in how long the remission lasted and in overall survival. Now, one of the questions that often comes up to us is the group at Arkansas takes a very aggressive chemotherapy-based induction using a combination called VDT-PACE. They then do two transplants, and they do 2 years, and they do a 2-year maintenance with RVD as well. And their 2-year survival is only 50% versus the 90% plus survival we have at 3 years. And while I would like to be able to say that it has to do with being able to get your treatment in Atlanta versus Little Rock, Arkansas, I'm not sure that that's completely responsible for the difference. I think one of the important distinctions between the total therapy approach and the approach that I just described that our group has published on is the fact that our group really only exposes patients to DNA-damaging chemotherapy at one time, and that's during the transplant. There's no true DNA-damaging chemotherapy in the beginning, and there's no true DNA-damaging chemotherapy that's given after the transplant. And one of the things I mentioned earlier that distinguishes high risk from standard risk myeloma is how fast the cells are dividing. But a second feature that distinguishes high risk from standard risk myeloma is how unstable the DNA is in patients with high risk myeloma. It tends to be a lot more fragile or unstable, and that leads then to additional genetic abnormalities that can accumulate over time easier in a high-risk patient than a standard-risk patient. And so our philosophical approach at Emory is that we want to minimize exposure to chemotherapy, to true DNA-damaging chemotherapy, because of the fact that the DNA is more fragile in high-risk patients. And that's why I think our data is so different from the Arkansas approach. They use a lot more chemotherapy, which in a high-risk patient, I think, results in a lot more DNA damage and DNA changes, as opposed to our approach, which uses less chemotherapy, and thus, I think, keeps the DNA more stable. Now,
a couple of other
questions before we open it up to the panelists and to other listeners that I think is worth discussing about is I often hear descriptions about using risk-adapted induction treatment. And what that presumes is that we know what to treat patients with, whether they are standard risk or high risk, at the very beginning of their presentation with myeloma. And what I would argue is that I think that that is incorrect. I think you want to give every patient at their diagnosis the best, most effective treatment that you can give them and use the genetics to tailor how you do their maintenance therapy. For instance, at our center, patients who have standard risk myeloma all still get that same RVD treatment in the beginning. However, they only get lenalidomide or Revlimid in the maintenance setting. Patients that have high risk get that same three-drug treatment up front, and they get three-drug maintenance with RVD. Patients that have 414 translocation, again, get that same three-drug RVD-based induction because that's the best treatment for patients at the time of initial diagnosis, and then they get just bortezomib or Velcade in the maintenance setting because that's what we know is important once you've completed initial therapy. So I don't like the idea of limiting therapy to good-risk patients and giving more therapy to high-risk patients at the beginning. I think everybody should get the best treatment at the beginning, and then you use the genetics to try and tailor how the treatment should be given after the initial therapy in the context of maintenance or consolidation. So I think I've covered some of the important highlights of our data and our philosophical approach to treating patients and identifying patients with high-risk myeloma. Gary and Priya, do you want to begin a discussion at that point?
Well, I think, you know, you've touched on a number of the questions that I was going to lead you through. You did a great job of it, as a matter of fact. And I do believe that those results that you show for RVD are, in fact, outstanding. And you've done a great job of explaining, you know, your philosophy behind that. One of my questions, however, would be what are some of the specifics of the trial group? You know, what was the age of the group? What are some of the other factors? And this was a clinical trial, correct?
It was a series of patients all treated at our center in the same way. So we agreed about 5 years ago to treat everybody the same way who presented in a certain fashion.
Okay.
And so what we did was then we all had the same orders, we had the same standard treatments, and what we did was just collect that information over time and see how patients did. And so basically the only inclusion was that patients had to be eligible for a transplant. If they were considered eligible for a transplant, then we treated them all with the same initial therapy. They all received a single cycle of high-dose therapy and transplant, and then they all went on to this RVD maintenance approach.
Okay. You know, and that was really one of my questions is, like, in clinical trials, frequently, you know, people with kidney damage or other higher-risk features are excluded, as well as...
We took consecutive patients who presented with high-risk disease at our center.
So there was really no limitation other than the one that you mentioned, which is truly remarkable then to see that kind of an outcome. In addition, you mentioned the UAMS program, and there was a number of differences that I saw between yours and theirs, one of which is, at least in their Total Therapy 3 program, they use VDT PACE. So they didn't use Revlimid, and is that PACE also provide, you know, some of the damage to DNA that you were talking about?
Yeah. So PACE is platinum, adriamycin, cyclophosphamide, and etoposide, and those are all what we call genotoxic agents, meaning traditional chemotherapy drugs that work by interfering with DNA replication or inducing DNA damage. You're right. I mean, I think using an older drug like thalidomide, doesn't offer necessarily the same benefits that using Revlimid or lenalidomide can offer. I think the addition of chemotherapy in that context does, again, raise that question about DNA damage. Again, it's a theoretical concern. I won't tell you that answer has been proven. But we do know that high-risk myeloma is more genomically unstable. The DNA is more fragile. And so it just sort of follows that the more chemotherapy you expose lots of unstable DNA to, it's like pouring gasoline on a fire. And sometimes you have to do it. Sometimes you have no choice. But if you have a choice, and we did in a significant fraction of patients, you want to try and limit the exposure.
I also noted that you used RVD, and according to Dr. Richardson on one of the prior cure panels, he indicated that RVD is more effective than VRD, just the sequence by which you provide, you know, these drugs. Do you agree with that? Is that something that you've included in your
I'm trying to understand. I think we think of those two as being the same. RVD is Revlimid Velcade Index, and VRD is Velcade Revlimid Index. Unless he's thinking of a different V.
He's actually thinking of, the sequence. You'd give Revlimid first, followed by Velcade Index, as opposed to Velcade Revlimid Index. I think it has something to do with, because it Revlimid thalidomide tends to kind of rev up the immune system, correct?
That's correct. That's correct. We give it in a dose and schedule, actually, that's in the paper that we published with Dr. Richardson, combining Revlimid and Velcade Index. So it's not really a sequence. They're both given at the same time.
Okay.
And we joined Dr. Richardson on that study.
Okay. One last question from me, and what I'll do is then turn it over to the group for additional questions, and I've got a couple as well. So many times I hear from patients that they have been screened for, they have not been screened for chromosomal abnormalities. This seems like a key to deciding on the proper treatment selection, at least for Mayo's M-SMART. Now, you mentioned that you didn't necessarily agree with that, but don't you worry, isn't it important that you find out whether someone's high risk or low risk?
Absolutely, and that has to be done at the time of diagnosis. I don't disagree with that at all. And in fact, I think that information is almost more important than any other set of information from the bone marrow. And one of the challenges, as you describe, is patients who don't have that done, and a lot of times it's because it's not decided by the oncologist, it's decided by the pathologist. And they may not, if they don't see enough myeloma, they may not appreciate the importance of knowing what the genetics are in a patient at the time of diagnosis. Another major issue that we see at the time of diagnosis is that the FISH testing that I mentioned earlier is not done in the manner that provides us with the most information. So I mentioned earlier that FISH testing allows us to look for common genetic abnormalities, whether or not the cells are dividing. In order to do that most effectively in myeloma, you have to know that you're actually looking at the myeloma cells. And so if the lab doesn't look at FISH testing in the myeloma cells, they may be looking at normal cells and telling you that we don't see anything here. And that information is not very useful because it's not truly a negative result. It means they didn't do the test in a way that provides us with the most important information. And so I think not only do you have to get the test done at diagnosis, it's probably one of the most important pieces of information to get at diagnosis. You also have to get it done in a lab that does it the right way, so you can make sure that the information you get is either appropriately informative or is appropriately not informative, and that's okay too. Now, my disagreement with the M-SMART approach is not to not get the information. It's that I don't think you should decide initial treatment based on the genetics. I think you should use the genetics to decide how to appropriately maintain a patient once they've achieved a response.
Okay. Well, thank you very much on that. And one last point, which has to do with the group and what kind of group of patients that you had. Would you say that, I noticed that you used, I think it was 414, but there's only two patients, which was 5% of the total, that you mm-hmm. used a group of patients, and also 11 of them were, leukemia patients, is that correct, or plasma cell leukemia patients?
Plasma cell leukemia, I don't have the number in front of me, but it was at least 5 or 6. It may have been as high as 11, yeah.
Yeah, well, and they were treated in exactly the same way, but you would consider them equally as high risk as, say, deletion 17P or translocation 14, 16?
Yeah, so many of them had 17p deletion or 1416 translocation. The 414 patient that we got there that's in there is a patient that also had 17p deletion. So it wasn't 414 alone. It was 414 in combination with some other features.
Oh, I saw the 34 of the 44 or 55 patients that came, or 45 patients. 34 of them had multiple cytogenic abnormalities, which I would assume makes it even more difficult.
Yeah, yeah. This was not an easy group of patients to.
Yeah, well, you've had remarkable results. Okay, what we'll do now is we'll go on to the panel. Jack, are you there?
I am here. Dr. Lonio, thanks so much for being part of this discussion.
Oh, thank you.
I had just one question with respect to the trial. I presume the RVD maintenance dosages were lower than the RVD induction dosages. Is that correct?
Yeah. So what we did was rather than give the Velcade on a twice-a-week schedule as we did in the beginning, you know, day 1, 4, 8, and 11, we gave the Velcade weekly, so day 1, 8, and 15 every month, so three doses every month, and then the Revlimid we gave was 10 milligrams for 3 weeks in a row with a one-week break. So it was a lower dose.
And you picked the three-year fixed duration of maintenance because it was long enough?
It's a funny story. So we initially, as a group, said we're going to do 1 year. And we weren't sure how many patients would get through a year of treatment and how many patients would still be in remission at 1 year because it was a new idea. And so when we had a significant fraction of patients that stayed on for 1 year and got through without, you know, a lot of toxicity, we said, all right, now we're going to go to 2 years. And as it got close to 2 years, we said, you know, a lot of patients are still doing really well. We were afraid to stop. And so we said, all right, now we're going to go 3 years. And finally, at 3 years, we got to the point where we said, you know, this is a long time out. Why don't we just switch to Revlimid alone so patients don't have to keep coming in as frequently? And that made a lot of people happy that they didn't have to keep coming in to see us every week. So that was I can't tell you it was a real scientific reason. It was just a matter of practicality.
Got it. Thank you. I wanted to ask a question that was asked of me. It's a high-risk patient who has comorbidities. So he doesn't have necessarily the translocation factors, but he'd be considered because of the high-risk patients. And he's 78 years old. He has renal impairment and diabetes. One of his oncologists is suggesting no treatment but only dialysis. The other one is suggesting Velcade Index and as induction treatment. And I'm wondering what you would say. For example, Dex can be hard on a diabetic patient, so maybe Velcade only. But how might you proceed?
Yeah, that's a good case. And I think the first question I would ask you, Jack, is the renal impairment due to myeloma or due to diabetes and other medical issues?
Due to myeloma.
If it's due to myeloma, then this patient's outcome is in many ways associated with whether or not you can reverse that kidney failure. Because if you can, and in a significant fraction of patients that are treated early and aggressively, you can get them off dialysis. I would say at our center that number is around 50%. And so I would give that patient Velcade. I would probably add in a little bit of thalidomide, maybe 50 milligrams of thalidomide. And I think the point with Dex is an important one, but Dex is also very effective at clearing out plasma cells and getting rid of those light chains that are blocking the kidneys right now. And so I would try a little bit of Dex in the beginning, knowing that I can always back down. But if I'm going to make an impact on his kidney function and try and get him off dialysis, you sort of have to go in big and try early. And if you're successful, then you could wean the Dex down so that it was a little bit more manageable. But I go pretty aggressively and try to reverse renal failure because that's going to have a huge impact on his quality of life. And give him the best chance at long-term off dialysis survival that you can.
And a little bit of dex might mean like 20 milligrams a week, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, you could do that. I mean, the only situation now where I actually use the old-fashioned high-dose dex is in patients who present on dialysis. So I'm not advocating to treat a 78-year-old with high-dose dex. I guess what I'm saying is go as give as much as you think you can get away with safely, but know that you only need to give it for a short period of time.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you, Jack. Pat Killingsworth, your question.
Hi, doctor.
Hello.
I hear from a number of patients that say that their specialists feel that transplanting is a waste of time since they're a high-risk patient. So it's encouraging to see that you've had such good results. Could you just review why a physician would feel that way, that transplanting, if you're high-risk, just isn't going to work?
Yeah, so there is a thought out there that because patients relapse so quickly after a transplant, that perhaps the transplant is not offering the benefit that you would get with other disease subsets. And I think that the reason that happens is a failure to use adequate maintenance therapy. We actually had a small series of patients that we treated who had high-risk disease where all we really gave them was RVD. We collected their cells, but we didn't take them to early transplant, as I described in the paper that we published. And the problem we saw was that those patients relapsed pretty quickly as well. So in an anecdotal experience, for patients with high-risk disease, I'm not sure that not giving the transplant is necessarily the best approach, based, again, on our experience. Now, there is a series of data from European groups, and this came predominantly from a German study, a Dutch study, and there is some data from the Spanish as well. And the Spanish actually take almost the exact opposite tact, which is to say they think if there's a group of patients that really benefit from two transplants, it's the high-risk cohorts. And in fact, they've got some analyses, some subset analyses they performed from large randomized trials that suggest that the only patients who really benefited from tandem transplant were the highest risk of patients. I'm not sure I completely believe that now, but it at least gives the idea that the role of transplantation for high-risk patients is not gone. And in my mind, if I can give you a rationale why I think that's the case. So there are two trials now that have been published from the Italians, not looking at high risk, just looking at myeloma patients in general. And using MRD testing, they showed that the reason patients who have a transplant versus those who don't in their randomized trial stay in remission longer, even though the CR rate by conventional criteria is the same, is because more patients in the transplant group achieve an MRD negative complete remission than in the non-transplant group. And so I would take that data and extrapolate it to high-risk patients, saying the problem with high risk is not that they don't respond, it's that you don't get the response deep enough. And if you get it deep enough and then maintain it with aggressive three-drug maintenance, you may be able to keep it under control much longer than if you don't do the transplant or if you don't do maintenance. There's a long answer to your question.
Now I recall seeing that tandem transplant, high-risk transplant data.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, so extrapolating out, it's 4.5 years, and one of these patients relapses, high-risk patients relapses, would you consider transplanting them again?
You know, that's a good question. I think we do have a lot of good drugs that are in the pipeline now, and so we have not done that routinely in our patients who have relapsed with high-risk disease. We do have cells available, so I'm not saying we're not able to do that, but I think if you've got drugs like carfilzomib and pomalidomide that may offer additional benefit in high-risk patients. We've now got the monoclonal antibodies. I think we've got enough other things in the pipeline that I would try those first, knowing that I can potentially fall back on a transplant if I need it.
Sure. Great. Thanks, Gary.
You bet. Thank you, Doctor. I've got a question from Nick Van Dyke, and he would like me to ask it. It has been noted that low-risk disease that is treated and has remission for a period of time can return as high-risk disease. Understanding that the designation of high risk is really disease that doesn't respond to drug use well, what is the cause for this changing disease biology? Is it simply outsmarting the therapy? Is it a clonal tide function, or is there something else going on? Do some types of therapy make this more likely than others? Are there any predictive indicators or tests that can determine who is at risk for this type of reoccurrence versus a simple relapse? Is this disease evolution inevitable? Ultimately, once the armamentarium is exhausted, what treatment strategies have been seen to be most effective in delaying the inevitability of the transition to inevitability of this transition to high-risk disease?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think that there are two sets of explanations for that phenomenon of a patient presenting with standard risk disease and then relapsing with high-risk disease. The first is that the genetic testing that was done at the outset did not accurately represent what was really there at the initial diagnosis. And so while what you thought you were dealing with was standard risk disease, in reality, it was not standard risk disease, and that's what came back very, very quickly once the patients relapsed. The second is a situation where over time, the disease does evolve. It does get smart. And one of the most common mutations to develop over time in a myeloma cell is deletion of 17p or loss of p53. And so when I'm asked often, should I recheck genetics when a patient relapses, my answer is yes. You should recheck genetics every time you look in the marrow because you want to know, has the disease evolved over time into something that's much more resistant than it was the first time I saw it. And the acquisition of new mutations is part of what myeloma cells do as they come back over and over and over again. Now, as I mentioned early on, are there things that you can do that may predispose selection of a clone that may be more high risk than others? And that's hard to know. We don't know that right now. We will hopefully get some information about that from the COMPASS trial. And for those of you who are not familiar with COMPASS, COMPASS is a large 1,000-patient newly diagnosed trial where we know what treatment the patients got, and we know what the genetics of their myeloma was at diagnosis, and we'll hopefully know what the genetics is when the myeloma comes back. And we can then go back and say, patients who started here and ended with high risk, did they get a different treatment than patients who started at the same place but didn't end up as high risk? So those trials to answer that question are in progress. But one of the principles that I abide by to minimize the risk of genomic instability and transformation is to reduce exposure to DNA-damaging agents early on in the disease course. So that's the reason why we don't use melphalan, we don't use cyclophosphamide, we don't use doxorubicin, all those other chemotherapy drugs in that initial treatment of patients with myeloma. Now, once we've achieved a remission, we may consider high-dose melphalan as part of the transplant, but you've already reduced the myeloma burden when you make that step, and it's quite different than exposing all the myeloma cells at diagnosis to DNA-damaging agents like cyclophosphamide or Cytoxan, which I think can potentially be akin to pouring gasoline on a fire.
Well, thank you, Doctor. I had a question as well, and I noticed that the Myeloma Beacon actually had a publication on a French study that pretty much mirrors the one that you published. And there was 31 patients. However, it was for all patients, not just the high-risk patients, but I think they said 27% of them were high-risk. And
yep.
They had a three-year survival of 100%. So obviously what you're talking about has some significance. The one thing that they mentioned also was that patients that got that obtained an MRD negative status were far, whether in either case or in all cases, were more likely to have the best outcomes. So my question to you is that, you know, I didn't notice anything about MRD testing in your analysis. Are you going to be doing that? Do you think that is can perform a vital function or has value to your studies?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And let me just say, I think that French study that you're referring to that was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology is really an amazing study. And even though it's small, I think it's 31 patients, I think the lesson it's teaching us is really important. And the lesson it's teaching us is that when a patient presents with newly diagnosed myeloma, it's really important to have a planned and comprehensive treatment plan identified. And what they did in that French pilot study was say, everybody's going to get RVD, everybody's going to get a transplant, everybody's going to get RVD consolidation, and then everybody's going to get Revlimid maintenance after that. And that approach of this, you're going to do A, then B, then C, then D, I think is really important for all myeloma patients in 2014. Because what I see a lot of times is a patient will get started on a regimen and we'll see how they do. And then when it doesn't work, we switch to something else. And then when that doesn't work, well, now let's refer them for transplant. And that sort of fuzzy treatment plan, I think, ultimately limits the ability of patients to get the kind of benefits you can get from that very clear treatment planning that you see in the French trial. And you don't have to do it the way they did it. I just think every patient should have a clear treatment plan that everybody knows this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to get from point A to point B and achieve that in the most efficient manner that we can. Now, your question to me was about MRD testing. We did not do MRD testing on that initial series of patients that we reported on, and that was for a couple of reasons. One, the methodology for MRD testing was not as clear when we were performing that analysis as it is now. In our current high-risk approach, we are doing MRD testing at certain time points, so we will be able to get some of that information. We didn't have it for that initial paper.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And obviously with results like this, I'm kind of biting at the bit to be able to publish your results on my website. So whenever you guys can provide that, I'd just love to be able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now I'd like to open it up to some of the caller questions, and we've got quite a few. And if you don't mind, maybe we can even go over 5 or 10 minutes. Is that you have that flexibility in your schedule?
Good for
Doctor?
Me.
Okay.
Yes, good for
Fantastic.
Me.
Fantastic. All right. Priya, could you start bringing the people online? We have a load of questions from the field.
Absolutely, Gary. We have a couple of people who want to ask a question live. We have Dana Holmes calling in. Dana, you're on air. Please ask your question.
Thank you so much. Dr. Loniel, hi. How are you? My name is Dana Holmes, and I'm a smoldering multiple myeloma patient. I'm obviously interested in everything that you just had to say, but from a standpoint where I sit today, what would your best advice be to someone like me as far as trials are concerned? I know that you're involved in the Revlimid study, and there are several others out there, but how does a smoldering patient go about smartly figuring out which trial would be the best one to participate in?
Yeah, yeah. So that's a great question, and I think the most important thing probably to try and identify early on is what type of smoldering do you have? Do you have low risk, intermediate risk, or high risk? And as you know, or many of you may know, that doesn't necessarily matter with the genetics. It really depends on some simple things like free light chain ratio, size of the M protein, and percentage of plasma cells in the bone marrow. And if you have a sense of those three, you can put it into either high, intermediate, or low-risk smoldering myeloma. If you have low-risk smoldering myeloma, I wouldn't do anything because the median time for low-risk smoldering to develop myeloma is over 10 years. And so in 10 years, hopefully we'll have figured out what the answer is, and you can get treated then as opposed to now. If you're in the intermediate or high-risk category, I think it really depends on what trials you have access to, and you sort of have to feel comfortable with the institution and the consent form that they're giving you to look at. You disclosed my conflict of interest on this question, which is that I'm the PI on the National Revlimid versus Observation Clinical Trial. So, of course, I'm going to say that's really a good trial. And I think it is an important trial because while there is data from the Spanish that suggests that Revlimid and Dex was better than observation, I think the challenge with adopting that treatment to everybody is that the way they defined high-risk smoldering is not a way that we routinely do it here. And in fact, many of those patients in the trial would have been considered symptomatic myeloma, not smoldering, were they evaluated in the U.S. And so I don't think it's as clear-cut a question as that trial makes it look out to be. Now, it's a really great finding because that's the only positive trial in all of smoldering, but I think it doesn't answer the question in of its own, and so I think the ECOG trial of Revlimid versus observation is a really important question. I know that we've got a trial that we're participating in combination with the folks at Dana-Farber using a vaccine against a couple of epitopes. That, to me, is a really interesting question because right now we don't have a vaccine that works in myeloma, and there's no real downside. In fact, if anything, if you get the vaccine and it doesn't really work to control or to prevent development of myeloma, you still may have a small clone of T cells that are primed against those antigens that are on myeloma cells. And those T cells, if they're able to survive, may actually be incorporated in your stem cell graft. And so you may actually get those T cells back after the transplant and have some anti-tumor immunity that might help you at some point down the road. Now, again, this is all very theoretical, so I can't tell you that that's going to happen, but it's certainly an interesting thing to ponder. And then, of course, there are antibody trials that are being done looking at some of the monoclonals now that are more active in myeloma. I know that there are trials with some of the active CD38 antibodies that are either in progress or planned that I think would be interesting and important to look at as well. So I think those are all important questions. And if you feel comfortable with the site and you feel comfortable with the consent form, I think those are reasonable trials to embark on.
Thank you, Dr. Loniel. The criteria that you used are the criteria from the Mayo Clinic risk model. Am I right?
Right. Right.
Okay. Now, what about the risk models from the Spanish group that incorporate the aberrant plasma cell percentage, immunopheresis? Are they worked into these trials? Or because for me, it seems that we're dealing with two different kind of ways to establish that. In the Mayo group, I'm actually intermediate risk. But under the Spanish group, I'm considered high risk. So I'm, you know, in that, I guess that point where I think, well, gee, I would love to be considered intermediate risk and maybe hold off for a while, but if I truly am the high risk group, then it's something that I definitely should consider and pursue.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the challenge there is that if you look at overlap between the Mayo and the Spanish definitions, very few patients actually both fit into either the high risk by both criteria or into the low risk by both criteria. And so I just think there's such different methodologies. Did you have this the Spanish flow done in the U.S.? Because nobody really does that flow the way they do it. So I would say I mean, I feel pretty comfortable with the Mayo ECOG criteria that we're using in our trial. If you're intermediate by that and you're being followed, I think that's a reasonable way to move forward.
Okay. Now, just a point with that trial. There is a tertiary objective that I wondered about. It's item number 4. It states to study the prognostic value of MRI-detected asymptomatic bone disease on clinical outcome. What's the actual definition of MRI-detected asymptomatic bone disease?
So that would be either marrow involvement or a single lesion that was identified by MRI that is not present on a skeletal survey.
Okay. Thank you so very much for clarifying that. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, okay. Dana. Priya?
The next caller calling in from 735-0469. You're on air. Please ask your question.
Hi, this is Susie Rose, Dr. Laniel, and I had a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm here.
I had a question. I think I took from your overall message that in terms of high risk, the most pivotal point is that you reach MRD negative versus the treatment regimen. Did I understand that right?
I think you want to use the treatment regimen that has the highest likelihood of getting you to complete remission. How about that?
Right. And I said that because you mentioned the tandem transplants where at one point being not so great for high-risk patients. Then we have Chang in 2005 saying high-risk patients have dismal outcomes with high-dose chemotherapy. And now we're seeing that when we use the triple combo, add in the high-dose melphalan, as you've been doing with the RVD consolidation and maintenance, that the patients are doing well. So it seems when we look across the spectrum, and you were comparing the other two trials as well, the French and the, the Italians, I think, and that it's the regimen that's being used. And if that regimen does not get the patient to MRD negative, then they're not going to have great outcomes. So I don't know if it's a particular regimen, that's what I'm saying, that does that, or if it's just getting to MRD negative, as long as you get there.
Yeah, so the MRD question is harder for me to answer in the context of our data because we didn't measure that. But I think that the proteasome inhibitor, IMID, so the, you know, the Velcade, Revlimid combination, I think is very, very effective. It's very potent. It can get even high-risk patients into a complete remission. And then you build on that remission with the transplant and then maintain that remission with the maintenance therapy afterwards. That's sort of the principle, I think, that we described in our paper. So I think it's a little bit of both of what you're saying, not just one or the other.
The other question that I had was regarding the different cell populations when we're talking about getting to MRD negative. We're looking at, you know, flow cytometry. We're looking at next generation sequencing. And recently there was an overview article, and it basically said because flow cytometry basically delineates for us mature plasma cells, whereas next-generation sequencing gets us premature plasma cells, and that, according to Tiedemann, did I say his name right? Tiedemann? Is that his name? T-I-E-D-E-M-A-N-N. He says that if we don't hit that second reservoir of progenitor cells, that we continue to relapse. So my question is, do we capture all of those match all of those populations on flow cytometry? Or does flow cytometry only give us the mature cells so we can say we're in MRD negative, but if we did next generation sequencing, it might pick up the progenitor population and we really aren't in MRD negative?
Yeah, that's a great question. So flow cytometry does have the ability to pick up the mature end-stage plasma cell, and it actually is very good at identifying some of those progenitors as well. What is sometimes hard to know by flow is whether those progenitors carry the same mutations or VDJ recombination if they're in the same family as the mature myeloma cell is. And that's where I think sequencing does offer significant benefit, because we know that we're going to sequence that the what's called the VDJ region, the region that identifies a unique specific plasma cell. We can do that with sequencing, and you can probably get better resolution. You can go deeper in terms of MRD potentially with sequencing than you can with flow. So I think they both have their pros and cons, and I think it's going to be a matter of tracking outcomes using both methodologies that'll help give us the answer for what the best approach to move forward is.
And that was my thinking, is that even if you've got MRD negative on flow, you want to do that additional next generation sequencing because it adds information
as to where we are.
Yeah,
I would agree.
Good. Thank you so much.
Susie Rose.
Sure.
Okay, Priya, next question.
Yeah, Dr. Lonil, we have a long list of questions, and I've actually shared them with you. I will just quickly go over them, and we can hopefully complete, get to answering at least some of them. The first one is, if the FISH test was not done at the time of the bone marrow biopsy, are there other ways to tell if you are high risk or to infer that you are high risk?
Yeah, that, then you start going by the old-fashioned clinical criteria of LDH, a lab measure that might be abnormal, kidney function, beta-2, and ISS staging, that kind of stuff. But, you know, if there's a patient who didn't have it done that sees me within the first few cycles of treatment, I will often repeat the marrow to try and get that information. So, while ideally it should be done at before initial treatment is started, it can be done as long as there's disease there to measure. And so I would still do the test as long as the patient wasn't in a complete remission.
The next question is Timothy, who asks, I want to know if age is one of the risk factors in the progression of NRAS to multiple myeloma.
So age in and of itself is not necessarily a risk factor. However, we know that the longer one has MGUS, the higher likelihood they are to convert to myeloma, simply from doing the math. If you have MGUS and there's a 1% per year risk of progression, if you have MGUS for 20 years, then your 20% will progress to myeloma. So if you're 40, one in five patients who are 40 will progress to MGUS by the time they're 60. On the other hand, if you're 75 with a life expectancy of another 10 years, only 10% will have converted. While the risk of progression is exactly the same, the years of life at risk goes up when you're younger, and that ultimately converts to a higher number.
The next question is from Joseph, who says that he has multiple myeloma for the last 3 years. He went to a stem cell in Feb 2014. What he wants to know is that he has very bad leg and back pains and has been on pain medication, but it's not helping him. Now he's on Velcade and Zometa, says the stem cells did not put him into remission but made my levels go down. He has had CAT scan and MRIs, and they show nothing. When he was first diagnosed, he had 4 fractures and kyphoplasty to correct the fractures, and the bottom of his lungs were compromised. Now, can you suggest something to help him with the pain?
I think these are always tough to answer without knowing all the specifics, but obviously the use of long-acting narcotics like MS-Contin and OxyContin can be very helpful. If the pain is really associated with Velcade-related neuropathy, then switching to something like carfilzomib may be a different option. There are some things that can be done to try and maximize pain relief, and a lot of those are dependent on the specific patient circumstance.
Okay, the next one is from Kelly, who says, when you're dealing with patients that have multiple prognostic indicators for high risk, in particular 17p, IQ21, and FISH 13 deletion, how do you determine the most appropriate treatment regimen?
Yeah, so for this patient that's had an unfortunately very, very challenging treatment course, I think they need to get to, and Duke is a good center, get to a place that's got clinical trials, because this is a patient that's seen many, many drugs already, and I think monoclonal antibodies would certainly be a potential option. I see they've tried Xalinza. The question is, would panobinostat potentially offer something different? The Array 520 compound targets highly proliferating cells. That would be another potential thing to look at. So I think that this patient is somebody that's in need of a clinical trial, and find a center that's close that you can get to offer that.
The next question is from Lisa, who writes in that her 37-year-old sister has been diagnosed with multiple myeloma. And she was severely anemic and has been found to have acute kidney failure. She was placed on Cyborg upon diagnosis. And first week of treatment, her light chains went from 40,000 to 14,000. After suffering severe strep infection and a port site, her light chains rose back to 40,000. Her creatinine at diagnosis was 14. And she has had no symptoms other than fatigue prior to diagnosis. She has had no dialysis, only rounds of plasma cirrhosis. Doctors are amazed with her otherwise perfect health, and her bone scan has shown no issues. She says that after the infection, her sister has been switched to RVD regimen. She wants to know if... she wants to know if this is the right treatment or whether there's anything that you can offer her as for advice, because of her sister's young age, she's not finding enough information. That's what her issue is.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think certainly the treatment course sounds reasonable. It's hard to know what happens to the free light chain sometimes when patients have that severe level of renal dysfunction. Without knowing the whole story about kidney function and recovery, these are patients, even if they don't recover their kidney function, that we try to take quickly to stem cell collection and even transplant them if they're in good enough shape to try and get as quick a control as you can. It sounds like there's an appointment next week with a myeloma specialist that'll help sort some of this out. But I think moving forward with a treatment plan is important at this point to try and save the kidneys and ultimately get this 37-year-old back under control.
Okay, the next question is from Kate. She's asking, what is being done to enhance deeper responses from ASCT for high-risk patients? For lack of a better term, enhancement is used here for such things as MD Anderson using 50 mg Revlimid for 3 or more days prior to stem cell transplant. Dana Faber speaks of consolidation and augmented maintenance for high-risk ASCTs.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the augmented maintenance that Dana Faber is talking about is our data, the RVD maintenance data.
Yeah.
I don't know that the addition of Revlimid prior to the transplant offers any benefit. We actually did a trial adding Velcade to high-dose melphalan for the transplant, and while I think it did offer some benefit, I can't tell you that it worked for every patient, and we've not used that treatment for every patient. So I think if somebody wanted to participate in a trial, as is being done at MD Anderson, combining Revlimid with transplant, I think that's a perfectly reasonable approach to go in. But outside of that, I'm not sure I would change the conditioning for the transplant itself and, again, focus on the maintenance for patients after transplant.
She also wants to know if you could speak a bit about the trials related to the FGFR3 expression.
So there have been a couple of trials that are looking specifically at FGFR3 inhibitors in patients who have 414 translocation and FGFR3 overexpression. To date, those trials have not shown enhanced efficacy either in all patients or in the patients with 414 translocation. It's not clear how good those inhibitors were, though. I know that there are other drugs that are in development, as well as drugs going after the other half of the 414 translocation, which is MMSET. and those drugs are in early development as well. So I think there are a number of things that are being done in that arena that can help. What we do know about FGFR3 overexpression is that they seem to be exquisitely sensitive to proteasome inhibitors. In our experience, as I mentioned, using the RISC to try and identify how to maintain patients, patients who have the 414 translocation at our center are offered bortezomib-based maintenance, again, because we know bortezomib can be so effective in patients with FGFR3 overexpression or the 414 translocation.
Yeah, the last question which has just been sent in about an hour ago is from Lisa, I think. Yeah, and she says her mother has been diagnosed with multiple myeloma. She has 17p deletion, and she underwent an autogenic stem cell transplant in September last year and was not started on maintenance therapy. The myeloma returned in January. She was started on Velcade and Dex in April, and more recently, Kyprolis and Pomalyst. And she was also told, she was told this July that presence of high-risk markers, and she was recommended allotransplant. Her mother is 65 years old and otherwise very healthy. Her question, she says, is, I have not read much that recommends this course of treatment as the risks are great and the potential for a good outcome is slight. What is your opinion?
So this is always a bit of a dicey question for me because in my mind, there's a lot of potential toxicity with an allogeneic transplant, and there's very little data that says in patients with high-risk disease that allotransplant offers significant improvement in outcomes. Now, having said that, not doing an allotransplant, we know sort of the natural history of high-risk disease. So it becomes a risk-benefit ratio that every patient needs to make that decision on their own and know that carfilzomib and pomalidomide, which is what the patient is on now, is very effective for 17p-deleted patients, but it's not going to last forever. And so do you want to take the risk of doing a transplant that may offer a 10 to 15% chance of long-term disease-free survival with its coincident side effects of infections, transplant-related mortality, and graft versus host disease, or do you want to take your chances with just drug therapy? And every patient has to make that decision for themselves, and it's not one that I can make for any patient based on my experience.
Any other questions, Priya? Are you there? I think we must have dropped Priya somehow.
Yeah. Hi, Gary. This is Shweta here. I'm taking over for Priya. She just dropped for some reason. I think, yeah, the questions.
Shweta,
others,
thank you
questions.
So much. I'm back.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that was just right. A draw there. Thank you so much. Yeah. Dr. Loniel, thank you so very much. I think we almost come to the end of the show. It's almost more than an hour, and thank you for the extra time, too. And Gary, Jack, and Pam, thank you so very much. The link for today's broadcast will be shared with all our participants. Please join us again on 28th August for our on-air Myeloma Support Group meeting with Pat Killingsworth and Jenny Allstrom of Myeloma Crowd, where we will be discussing ways that patients and caregivers can help boost myeloma research. And on 17th September, we will be talking to Dr. Tricott on minimal residual disease. Please visit curepanel.carefree.net to register for our shows. Until then, thank you so very much. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much, Doctor. You were excellent.
Thank you.